will put up the first talk and then let's go. Always leave the clicker here, please.
Hey.
Just a minute.
I can already start.
There we go.
So this is about a little tool that I've developed for quite a long time, but I haven't actually really advertised it a lot. And lately I've thought I should make it a bit more usable for more people and maybe make it a bit more well known. So the thing is you have web applications. So maybe you run a personal web page or a company web page or whatever, a blog with one of these popular content management systems or other web applications. Sometimes they have security vulnerabilities. And then maybe you forgot to update them, and that's bad, and then you get hacked, and then you have some JavaScript that's mining cryptocurrency, and you're sending spam and all these things, or maybe you're hosting phishing pages now, which you don't want. That's all quite annoying, and maybe your web hoster will then tell you that, he will shut down your web page. So you should better update. You should use WordPress. I'd like to say this. WordPress has kind of a bit of a bad reputation. I think WordPress is definitely the most secure content management system you can get because it has automatic updates. But let's assume you run a server for other users, which I actually do, and you want to know if your users update their web applications because it's also annoying for you as a server admin if you send spam or whatever. So you would like to check if your users actually update their web applications. And that's where you need FreeWBS, which is the tool I developed for this. So this is kind of how it works. So you run it and give it a path, and then it will tell you, it seems there's a Joomla version 3.9.11, and that has a known security vulnerability. And there's also a Nextcloud and a MediaWiki also with known security vulnerabilities. That's kind of how it works in the backend. That's the data that it has, in this example, MediaWiki. So I maintain this myself. People often are curious, and I manually do this, but it's not as much work as people think. So it knows that there's a safe version, and there are some older branches that are also safe versions. There's a vulnerability, and then there's some information how to detect the version. So if there's a file default settings PHP that contains a variable VG version, then that means there's a MediaWiki in that version. It's actually 12 years old, so I've been doing this for quite some time. It's free software under a CC0 license, which means you can do with it whatever you want. It's written in Python, uses some string matching and regular expressions, which is a bit ugly, but there's no better way to do it. And then compares it to data about vulnerable versions. Please try it. I tried to make it more usable. You can now install it via pip, but there's also some design decisions where I'm not really sure how to do it yet, particularly about the data and how to update that. If you're good at Python and want to discuss how to best do that or discuss improvements, please come to me, talk to me, and please try it out. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. So next up is Pocket Science Lab.
Hello, good morning. My name is Mark. I'm a software developer. I'm talking about hardware, which may sound a little bit strange, but I'll explain that in a few seconds. Pocket Science Lab is a little hardware which lets you measure all kinds of things. Why I like to use it, you see here, this is my set, little lab, which I have to get out of the boxes in the evening, play around with microcontrollers, and put it back into the boxes again when I'm done, because this is also the table where my family eats breakfast, where my wife has a home office where my son likes to play Legos. And where I like to play with hardware. I don't have much room to have an oscilloscope or stuff like that, and that's why I'm happy to have found this Pocket Science Lab device thing. You use it by connecting it to your computer or to your smartphone via USB. Wi-Fi connection is currently being developed. Hope to see that soon. You install software. I'll come to that later. And then you just connect things to the Pocket Science Lab with cables with little pins. So you, if you like to play with Arduinos or ESP32s or things like that, you stay in your little pins and cables world, and it all connects together quite nicely. The software has different screens for the different use cases. It also has help screens. So if you're clueless as me, you can just take a look at the help screen, and it tells you how to connect things, how you can measure things, or just what you can do with the device. You can get the software from the website, pslab.io, but you can also get it, the software for the phone. You can get it from Google Play Store or from F-Droid. What can you do with it? You can substitute an oscilloscope, multimeter, or logic analyzer. Maybe if you're like me, you don't have much space. You just need a small device, or you travel a lot, and you don't want to carry a lot of things with you. Then you can create test data with a wave generator. You have a programmable power source. Or you can just look at things by connecting sensors. And you can either display values from the sensors, or you can log it and analyze it later. I forgot to say, I'm not a developer of the device. I'm only a user, and I'm happy to have found it. So if you like the device, if it looks interesting, just come to the FOSS Asia assembly. It's in Hall 2. They have devices there. They have cables. They have sensors. You can play around with it. You can buy it if you want. You can maybe get tips how to build it yourself, because it's open hardware. You can build it yourself. The firmware is free. Everything is free. They will be there until midnight, they told me. So if you like the device or would like to take a look, just go there and have a look. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is JMAP LTTRS.
Hi, I'm Daniel. So I originally got interested in this a couple of years back. I was trying to finally self-host my own email. And I was looking for an email client for Android that provided a similar user experience to Gmail, and I couldn't find any. So I thought, how hard can it be to write your own? That led me to look into email, which, in case you don't know, is the protocol most email clients use to fetch email from your server. So it turns out email is IMAP is a little bit of a mess. It's an extensible protocol, and you need a bunch of server-side extensions to provide a good user experience. But as a client, you're also expected to deal with servers that don't have those extensions, and that makes your client code quite bloated. Furthermore, IMAP doesn't use any of the well-established serialization formats like JSON or XML, so you cannot even use a stock library to pass the via format. Even if you get through all that mess, you still have to deal with MIME parsing, which is not a complicated thing. And also, like, sending emails requires yet another protocol. So luckily, there's an alternative to that called JMAP. So what is JMAP? JMAP basically is IMAP with all the cool extensions. And it will also make the server deal with all the MIME parsing. So as a client, you basically get a JSON structure with the email data that is essentially ready to display to the user. It's also stateless and doesn't require a persistent TCP connection, because you may hate that mobile phone vendors are preventing apps from keeping a persistent TCP connection in the background, but you just have to deal with that, and that's just how it is. So from a client developer's perspective, JMeg makes a lot of things a lot easier. However, it's still fully compatible to IMAP, so it can operate in the same data structure on the server, and you can just as well use an IMAP client and a JMeg client in parallel. And obviously, the server-to-server communication remains untouched as well. So that was what got interested me in JMeb, but it's not all what JMeb is. So JMeb really is a data synchronization protocol, more of a replacement for ActiveSync than just for IMAP. And in the future, it will also be able to handle calendars and contacts and so on. So what JMeb isn't, you still have to deal with some of the legacy mess of IMAP and email, for example, like text emails versus HTML emails. It won't provide a big noticeable difference for end users, because if you already have a well-functional JMeb client, you won't know the difference as a user. But from a client developer's perspective, this makes a lot of things a lot of easier. And yes, that's what I did. I wrote a client that's really not a lot of code. It's based on a JMeb library that I wrote as well, that acts essentially as a headless email client. So it handles everything an email client would normally do except for the UI, like sending emails, archiving emails, marking something as read, or flagging, unflagging. And the app itself is really limited, like no frills, no settings. I'm not planning to introduce any settings screen at all, because settings always invite feature creep, and I don't want that. It's heavily inspired by Gmail. The same backend, in the end, could potentially also power a command line client. So yeah, what can you do with it? You can read text emails. You can process emails, like marking something as read or flagging or marking it as important. You can write emails, and there's some light responding, like you can respond to an email and it will like match the proper email IDs, but it won't quote the email. Unfortunately, the biggest hurdle, if you want to try it, the only server software that supports this is Cyrus, and only the unstable Git version. Dovecat, which I'm sure a lot of you are running, is interested but hasn't started the work on it, as we are running out of time. I'm still looking for people to help me out with this project, and I'm available on Congress if you want to meet, and here are some links that you might want to check out. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Batch Magic.
So, yes. Hello. Okay, so this is really a great lightning talk session, because we are early, right? Awesome. Good job, guys. So, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity here to share a few updates about our project Batch Magic. So, right, it's a wireless project, and as we all know, wireless, that's magic. So you can magically create text and clip arts on LED name badges using Bluetooth. That's what we're doing with the badge here. Okay, and you charge it through a battery, through USB. So it's a badge, and it can be accessed through Bluetooth. What we are doing, developing an Android app, and also we are looking like to develop more and more apps on all the other clients, like desktop or iOS and so on. So what's the story behind it? We found these cool badges everywhere, and everyone loves light and blinky things, and we see a lot of this here at the Congress. But we had this app here, and this app is like mixed Chinese, is colorful, even though the badge is just like one color, and there are a lot of issues with this, and a lot of people wanted to do new things with it. So we thought, how can we develop an open source app? And we have a large community, but it's often like front-end developers, or it's like people who know about server setups and so on, and not so many people who really like hack and decode things. But then we were really happy because we found this guy here. So on Hacker News and everywhere, so there was a guy who said like, let's reverse engineer the LED name badges here using Bluetooth, and he really did it. He put up a blog post, and just like in the great hacker spirit, and also put it here online on GitHub and shared his work, right? And as we often see here also at the Congress, there's so many cool ideas, but actually often the like a lot of hackers have this spirit, I hacked it, it's working for me, it's working on my machine, here's the code, do what you want, and they move on. But for us it's also really nice because we have conferences like the FOSS Asia Summit or the Open Tech Summit in Berlin, and we want really like everyone to be able to use these badges. So what we did now is we made a call in the community here that we're working with. For example, I'm many years in Singapore and Vietnam, and we built this awesome community here around the FOSS Asia free and open source solutions. It's not just software, now also hardware. And we said, hey, now we have this hack, let's make an app for it. So we invited everyone and people showed up, right? So we have this app now, and yesterday I had some comments here of people who said, oh yeah, this is really polished, it looks really like a nice thing. And of course, it's on F-Droid, it's on Play Store, we still like a lot of things to solve and make it smoother and so on, but like most of it works. And we also had it already at the camp. And yeah, really nice, you can have clip arts, you can have different directions to show the text and so on, and yeah, do a lot of things. You can make it slower, you can make it faster, and write all kinds of text. So, some developments have happened in the recent months. For example, let's say you really make your badge and you create a lot, you make a clip art, and you know, you make it really nice and you want to share it with your partner or with your friends and so on. So we implemented now export badges to one device, share your configuration. Why not? Import, export. Then also a nice thing is that the original app doesn't have is drawing things. So you can now have a drawing mode where you draw on the badge and then you can have it as a badge kind of feature. And there can be a lot of more things that we can do here as well. And of course, like as you can imagine, we had crashes. So we fixed a lot of crashes. Interestingly, like most of the developers who joined were like from Vietnam and Malaysia and so on, and they don't use non-Latin scripts. Yeah, so interestingly, it was a Chinese origin, but we didn't support non-Latin scripts, so we started to do that. We fixed a lot in this direction also, so adding more and more scripts. So get in touch with us here on GitHub, on the channel, or join our Code Heat contest, which we have. This is how we also like invite more people to participate in our projects here at FOSS Asia. It's a coding contest where, for example, the winners could win a trip to the Singapore event in March every year. This is also like batch magic. We just added this project into this contest. Now the question is, what is next? Of course, talk to us. We have in Hall 2 in the decentralization cluster and assembly with FOSS Asia, and we want to do a lot more things. For example, what you see here, I hope you can recognize this, is like this kind of small fan, and these fans can have different words on it. Why not do this as a next fun project, maybe even add it here into the app where you can configure these fans? Why not do iOS? I personally don't use iOS, but interestingly here at the Congress, so many people use iOS, so I think we should have an iOS app, and some people actually just started, so if you want to join, just join us as well. And of course, we need the hardware to be open. We have a lot of open hardware projects in FOSS Asia with Batch Magic. Some people say, oh, that's too simple for me, I'm not interested, but maybe somebody is interested to join this, and let's make really the hardware itself also open, and that would be cool. Thank you very much. Join us in Hall 2.
Thank you. Next up is Path Auditor. There you go.
Hey. Hi, everyone. My name is Ciro. I usually like memory corruption bugs, but today in this talk, I want to talk to you about something a little bit else, a different class of vulnerabilities that I thought deserves a little bit more love, and show you how you can find them yourself. Because in the end, as long as it gives you a shell, that's OK for us. So I will talk about privilege escalation bugs. So just imagine what happens if you have this. This is called run by some process, which is running as root on your Linux box. and it's doing rename temfu by x, temfu bar to temfu by x. So the first thing you might notice here is, well, this doesn't make any sense. You can't move a directory into itself. Like, how is that supposed to happen? But the fun part about this is actually a privilege escalation vulnerability. And to understand why, we will have to take a quick look at what the kernel is actually doing. So the kernel will get the syscall. It will take the first path argument first and will resolve it. So it goes to slash, then temp, foo, bar. It takes a reference to this file. It could be a file or directory. The kernel doesn't know at this point. And then it goes on to the second one. And that's the same thing again, right? So you just slash, temp, foo. But on Linux, there are these things called symlinks. So what if a user can actually write to this directory and just replaces bar with a symlink at this point in time? Then the kernel will follow it, go to etc, for example, and move the file that it got before and move it to a different directory. So if this is running as root, this is bad, right? Because just imagine a user can mess with this and move an arbitrary file to etc cron, for example, and get it executed later as root. So there are two caveats to this that I want to mention, which is, number one, rename only works with, if it's on the same file system, it will not move across file system boundaries. So if temp is just a regular directory, it will work. If it's a tempfs, this case will not work. The other thing is, temp is usually a sticky directory, and symlinks are a little bit special in sticky directories, but this doesn't apply since we are two directories deep. In any case, you might wonder why I'm using such a complicated example, because like this class of bug, there's such much better examples than this that are much easier to understand. But well, this was actually a real bug. There's a tool called temp remover, which is trying to delete all files in temp, and it was doing exactly this to find out if something is a mount point. So now we want to find these kind of issues at scale to get them fixed, right? So there's a very simple idea that works surprisingly well in practice, which is, well, we can just hook all the functions. What if we can just install hooks on every process on the system running as root, take every function in the libc, like open, rename, whatever it is, just hook the function, and whenever you call it, you check the path. You try to figure out, can this path be somehow messed with by a user, because that might be unintended side consequences. Like, there might be unintended side effects. Of course, it depends a little bit how the value is used, what the function call is in the end, but it's usually a bug if this happens. So we wrote this tool, me and a coworker Marta, and you can try it out. It works like this. You build this library, libpathauditor it's called. You can use ldpreload. So the way it works is use ldpreload. This allows you to load the library into another process. And then we can override open, rename, and so on. And then just check if the path could have a vulnerability like this. And then afterwards, if it does, we just log it to syslog. And then you will have afterwards to check out the syslog, find all the alerts, and then look at them manually. But usually these are very fun because they always have these tricky side effects. For example, there was one case where a shell script was trying to cut a PID file to check if a process is still alive and kill it. But then if you cut an arbitrary file and follow symlinks, you might end up putting the content of the file into the arguments, and the arguments are visible by every other process on the system, so you would leak arbitrary files with this. So there's some really cool bugs in this. So long story short, you can find it on GitHub. If you have any questions, you can ping me on Twitter, or I will be at the CTF area most of the time. And I'm really sorry, I just noticed the build is broken. I will try to fix it as soon as possible. But in the meantime, just you have to fix up the includes like you see on the bottom. Just remove the third party mention, and then everything should work out of the box. If not, just let me know, and I can help you try to debug it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So next up is this talk. I'm interested how they spell it. I'd say Arsholotl, but let's see.
Okay, my talk is about axolotl. It's this small animal living in Mexico City, but it's nearly dying because of environmental issues. But axolotl is also the encryption mechanism that is used in the signal messenger. It's actually renamed to double ratchet at the moment. But Axolotl is also the app I'm programming. It's a cross-platform signal client. It works on nearly all operation platforms. It's written in Golang with Vue.js, HTML, JavaScript front-end. And you can send message, link signal desktop, create groups, send and receive attachments. Little history. It was developed by a developer that worked for Canonical during his during the Ubuntu Touch 3.0 in Canonical. It's a little bit, it was difficult when I took on the maintenance of the app because it wasn't documented the build process and it wasn't also not supported by the standard way of writing apps for Ubuntu Touch. So I took over. I included Golang support for Ubuntu Touch. I added database encryption. I added system notification. I still had the problem that on start of the app, the whole database was loaded in memory, and so it was really unresponsive when you have 10,000 messages that are loaded. And also, we got in contact with OpenWhisper to support the Ubuntu Touch or an alternative push client to get push messages, but unfortunately, they only support Google and Apple. This summer, I decided to rewrite the front end and rename it again. It improved a lot. We have a really responsive user interface now. But OpenWhisper is still not interested in supporting alternative push clients. But if someone is interested, we can do a merge request on the Signal server GitHub. I think it's only a few hundred lines of code, so it would be possible to do it. Here are some screenshots. The first one is still a SQML app. This is how it works on Ubuntu Touch. But I made it also working on Windows and on Raspberry Pi and everywhere. And you can register. And I still need some help because I want to package it and bring it to more people that you can use it. I need also people for the different systems to test it because I don't use Windows, for example, so it's always I'm missing some OSs for testing. And I also need help in some decryption functions that are only in the Java code of the Signal app, and I need to translate it to Golang to show, for example, profile images or prove the identity, the Signal identity. That's it. You can try it. It's in the, since some days, it's in the Snap store. So you can install a Snap package, or you can download it from the sources, build it yourself, or I have also the Windows build on GitHub. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Next up is Congress Design on an Oscilloscope.
Yes, hello, I'm Quanten, and I've brought our Congress design to an oscilloscope. So what do we have? We have this wonderful Congress design with the cracking characters from LeapTrack. And we have this Congress design generator, which is used to let these characters fall down and create cracks. And this is in our motto of the Congress and resource exhaustion. And I thought these cracks and these sharp outlines would be perfect on a vector display. each magnificent outline burned into phosphor. So I decided to put it onto an oscilloscope. So what I need for that? Well, I need the path data of the outline in XY samples, because an oscilloscope uses simply an electron beam to burn images on phosphor, and you need an X axis to deflect the beam in the one direction, and then another axis for the other direction. And then I need a path to get this data out of the browser JavaScript into an oscilloscope, because I'm not running on the same machine. So Paper.js, the library which all this generator is built around, it's very nice, it's featureful, wonderful to create animations, and it was really easy. You just need a for loop and go along the path and get all the points you need along the path. So I calculate I need maybe 1,000 points, so the path is so long, I go along and have an array of the points. So in the audio part, I used an audio output to put it onto the oscilloscope, and there is a full-featured web audio API in JavaScript. You have modular routing, input-output nodes, effect nodes, so you can basically mix music in your browser while you're mining bitcoins. And I didn't notice it until now, but it's kind of great, but it's JavaScript, but we are at resource exhaustion, so it's maybe okay. And yes, it's very easy, actually. You create an audio buffer source, put in both channels, and then they will pop out of your headphone jack. So all you need to do left is to connect your oscilloscope to your headphone jack, and you get in full the image. You see on the left side my laptop, and the right side the oscilloscope. I've created a small amplification circuit, not that important. And they don't have a video now here, but it's live, so you can look at the oscilloscope live where the characters are falling and breaking apart. And you also see some distortions in the oscilloscope image, because I don't care about the paths between the characters and all that like that. I will give another longer talk in German today at 19:45 at the Karlsruhe stage. It's a non-recording stage, so be sure to come around if you want to have a bit more background. I will explain how all these have a history, a bit more details in how you can implement it, and give an outlook what you can else do with this wonderful combination of Paper.js and web audio API. So today, 19:45 in German, sadly. If you have any questions, ask me. I'm Quanten, and you will find me at the Karlsruhe. Or you can ask me on Twitter at Quintus Quanten. Call me up, or have a look at the wiki page. I don't know how it's named. I think it's Browsers on Phosphor. And there you can also find everything you need to get in touch with me. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, next up is, are you ready to sustain it? This talk is going to be in German.
Hallo Kongress, ich bin schon wieder zu klein für den Screen. Mein Talk geht über Nachhaltigkeit in Software, ein derzeit häufig gehörter Begriff Nachhaltigkeit. Er kommt eigentlich, Clicker, aus der Forstwirtschaft, ist relativ alt, nicht eine deutsche Erfindung oder eine europäische Erfindung, gibt es eigentlich überall, wo es Holz gibt, weil Holz seit sehr langer Zeit eine knappe Ressource ist. Die Phönizier haben Nordafrika abgeholzt, die Venezianer haben den Velebit und Kroatien abgeholzt, die vor den Römern, wer war da, in Mesopotamien, haben den Libanon abgeholzt, also Holz war überall begehrt. Jetzt macht man das nicht mehr, jetzt achtet man darauf, dass man aus dem Wald nur so viel pro Jahr herausnimmt, wie in einem Jahr wieder zuwächst. Das ist der Grundgedanke von Nachhaltigkeit. Den hat unter anderem die Bits und Bäume-Konferenz letztes Jahr versucht, in die Softwareindustrie oder in die IT zu übertragen, hat dazu Naturschutz- und Umweltverbände eingeladen und einige Nachhaltigkeitskriterien aufgestellt. Auch die Bundesregierung kümmert sich um das Thema mit einem parlamentarischen Beirat. Die Schweiz hat Ähnliches. Ich denke, solche Initiativen gibt es nicht überall, aber häufiger. die dann jeweils Kataloge, Kriterien für was ist Nachhaltigkeit in Software aufstellen. Auch die katholische Kirche hat sich um Nachhaltigkeit gekümmert. In Hardware-Produktion ist es auch gewandert. Nun, was sind die Probleme? Die Probleme sind, wenn große Organisationen Dinge tun, dann wandert die Komplexität der Organisation in das Ergebnis. Das sagt Conway. Parkinson wiederum sagt, Software füllt immer sämtliche Ressourcen auf, braucht alles auf, verhält sich wie ein Gas, füllt den kompletten Raum. Und Techniker neigen dazu, technische Lösungen toll zu finden, vor allem wenn sie kompliziert sind. Das stellt Don Norman fest, das stellt Stephen Krug fest oder auch Eric Evans in der einschlägigen Fachliteratur. Und Komplexität scheint irgendwie beeindruckend zu sein und gut anzukommen. Das ist nicht gut, wenn es um die Reduktion von Komplexität geht, damit Dinge einfach werden. Unterfüttert wird das Ganze von der Möglichkeit, das zu tun, weil Moores Gesetz seit 50 Jahren circa exponentielles Wachstum bringt. Das heißt, es war nie vernünftig, sparsam zu sein, weil ja in kürzester Zeit die Hardware die schlecht programmierte Software doch noch abgestützt hat. Das hat bereits vor 25 Jahren dem Niklaus Wirth überhaupt nicht gefallen. Der hat einen Aufsatz, die Software-Explosion, vorgelegt. Den gibt es auch auf Englisch, weil der deutsche Vorläufer ist leider vom Springer Verlag nicht digitalisiert. In der GI-Bibliothek gibt es nur die Referenz auf den Artikel, aber nicht den Artikel selbst. Das Englische, das er ein Jahr später gehalten hat, gibt es aber beim Daniel Bernstein auf der Webseite als tolerierte Raubkopie wahrscheinlich. Auch Dijkstra hat das Problem angesprochen, also die Komplexität als wachsendes Problem. Software kann nur existieren, weil die Hardware so unglaublich zunimmt in ihrer Leistungsfähigkeit. Nun, was kann man da tun? Gibt es verschiedene kleine und Einzelorganisationen und Einzelpersonen, die versuchen da Alternativen aufzuzeigen. Ich denke aber, es hilft nur, einen radikalen Schritt zu machen und zu sagen, Software muss ohne Wachstum auskommen. Das heißt, meine heutige Software, die ich toll finde und gerne benutze oder die ich gebaut habe oder gerade baue, muss, um zukunftssicher zu sein, auch auf alter Hardware laufen können. Und da ist 5 Jahre ein ziemlich großer Zeitraum und lustigerweise auch das gleiche Kriterium beim ganz neuen blauen Engel für Software, der auch verlangt, dass Software auf 5 Jahre alten Systemen laufen kann. Weil nur dann ist glaubhaft, dass diese Software ohne Wachstum der zugrunde liegenden Hardware-Ressourcen benutzt werden kann und keine Neuinvestitionen von Hardware erfordert. Das ist der Grund. Software ist der Treiber für Hardware-Investitionen. Zu dem Thema möchte ich heute Abend zu einer Diskussion einladen in der Vintage Computer, im Vintage Computer Cluster um 8 Uhr. Wer Zeit und Lust hat, über dieses Thema zu streiten, das auch was Positives beizutragen, destruktiv zu sein, zu randalieren, was auch immer, würde mich sehr interessieren, wenn ihr vorbeikommt, mir eure Meinung sagt, wie kann IT-Industrie Nullwachstum erreichen? Herzlichen Dank für eure Aufmerksamkeit. Einen schönen Kongress und wascht euch die Hände.
Danke. Thank you. So, next up is Free Pascal.
Hello together, my name is Pascal Dragon. I'm a developer of the Free Pascal compiler, and I'd like to give you a quick overview of this open source cross-platform Object Pascal compiler. Quick history, it was originally started by Florian Klempfel on H2 1993. Originally written in Turbo Pascal and targeted the Go 32 version 1 DOS extender. Thus, it was a 16-bit application generating 32-bit code. In 1995, the compiler was able to compile itself, thus became a 30-bit application as well. Soon after, the first ports to other operating systems like Linux and OS 2, as well as the first other CPU, namely the Motorola 68000, followed. In 2005, Free Pascal was the first open source compiler for Windows 64 because we had our own internal linker and assembler as the new binutils weren't ready yet. Free Pascal is an open source compiler. The compiler and the tools are licensed as GPL version 2 or newer. while the RTL and the code library is licensed as LGPL version 2 with a static linking exception. This allows closed-source applications to statically link against the RTL and the code library without violating the license. Free Pascal is a cross-platform compiler. We support various processor architectures, for example, x86 in 16, 32, and 64-bit flavors, ARM in 32 and 64-bit, PowerPC in 32 and 64-bit, the Motorola 68000. Our youngest target is the RISC-V, also with 32 and 64-bit support, and we also support AVR with, as an 8-bit target. And we also support the JVM as a backend, which includes Android, and we have a WebAssembly backend in development. And as a speciality, we have a Pascal to JavaScript transpiler in the form of the tool Pass2JS. We also support a variety of operating systems. This includes the big Windows in 32 and 64-bit, Windows CE, or formerly called Windows Mobile, also Windows 3.11. We support various Unix-like systems like Linux, Mac OS X, or nowadays Mac OS, as well as Free OpenNet and Dragonfly BSD. We support the Amiga likes, namely Amiga 3.x on the Motorola 68000, Amiga 4.x on the PowerPC, MorphOS, as well as AROS. We also support various other operating systems like OS 2, DOS, with and without a DOS extender, the Atari ST, Mac OS Classic, and various gaming platforms by Nintendo, namely Game Boy Advance, Nintendo DS, Nintendo Wii, and the Switch through a third-party developer. And we also support developing on bare-bone hardware, which is mostly used for the AVR and ARM. Free Pascal is an object Pascal compiler. We support various existing language dialects through a mode concept, which allows to select the language modes per compilation unit. We cover various existing dialects like Turbo Pascal, Delphi, Mac Pascal, as well as the two Pascal standards, ISO Pascal and extended ISO Pascal. We also have two custom dialects that are similar to the Turbo Pascal and Delphi dialects, but have a few differences and restrictions. Free Pascal has a namespace module-like concept through units, which allows for fast compilation, which is also why C++ developers want that. As the name says, this is an object-oriented programming language. We have virtual methods, interfaces, a class meta type, something I really miss from C++ sometimes. We have extensive runtime type information, which is the basis for an IDE like Lazarus to retrieve information about the running code at runtime. And we also support generics, which are a bit of a hybrid between C++ templates and C# Java generics. If I've made you curious, give it a try. The current release is 3.04. You can download it at freepascal.org for various platforms. I'd also suggest you to use the Lazarus IDE in version 2.06, which you can get at Lazarus-IDE.org. You can also, if you have questions, talk to me on the Congress. I should be recognized there in theory. But that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is the Telnet Challenge, AKA Winkelkatzen Challenge. It's going to be a German talk.
Hallo, mein Name ist Dario. Wir sind eine Assembly.
Du kannst die Folien auch da unten.
Ja, ja. Genau. Ich bin so klein. Wir sind eine Assembly, die sich hier auf dem Kongress gegründet hat und seit 3 Jahren eine Assembly ist. Wir haben uns am 30C3 das erste Mal getroffen und haben so grob zusammengesessen an einem der freien Tische. Und seit 3 Jahren machen wir eine eigene Assembly, um so der Community ein bisschen was zurückzugeben, um irgendwas zu machen. Was machen wir? Wir machen zum einen Stickers, sind immer sehr beliebt und unsere Stickers haben den Vorteil, dass sie eigentlich keine Werbung für irgendwas sind, also für einen Hackerspace oder so, sondern sie sagen einfach nur, dass Telnet eben Klartext ist und man doch die Wahrheit sagen soll und schnell zum Punkt kommen soll. Das sind die Sticker der letzten Kongresse, den untersten, den könnt ihr bei uns auch noch abholen. Was wir auch anbieten ist, wir kaufen ziemlich viel bei AliExpress ein und den ganzen Kram schleppe ich immer mit hier hin. Und falls jemand hier unbedingt was basteln will, aber keine Teile hat, kann er die bei uns haben, wobei wir nicht versuchen, damit Gewinn zu machen, sondern nur die Leute zu unterstützen, die jetzt schnell was bauen wollen und keinen Bock haben, jetzt Ewigkeiten auf die AliExpress-Sachen zu warten. Dabei bieten wir aber auch an, euch zu beraten, wie man die Sachen sinnvoll verbaut. Also wenn ihr Probleme habt, wie kann man jetzt einen Motor an einen GPIO-Pin anschließen oder so, da seid ihr bei uns richtig. Was wir auch gemacht haben, wir haben ja ziemlich viele Leuchtdioden gekauft und die auf eine Tonne geklebt. Die seht ihr draußen und dadurch findet ihr uns. Das ist also unser Wahrzeichen, um uns schnell zu finden. Und das vielleicht für alle am interessantesten ist, dass wir eine Challenge machen, die hieß früher mal Winkelkatzen-Challenge, heute nennen wir sie Telnet-Challenge. Und wer die gewinnt, wer nämlich so eine Katze zum Winken bringt, die bei uns steht, der gewinnt ein T-Shirt. Vor 2 Jahren gab es das T-Shirt, wo Telnet Klartextreden draufsteht, danach gab es das untere und jetzt gibt es das, was ich anhab, allerdings in schwarz. Wir haben verschiedene Größen da und man muss nur die Katze zum Winken bringen. Da kommt er einfach zu uns zum Stand, wenn ihr das machen wollt. Das ist ein Spoiler für die erste und die letzte Stage. Also in der ersten Stage seht ihr da so einen heißen Draht, den man schaffen muss. Die letzte ist die Katze da im Hintergrund, die ihr zum Winken bringen müsst. Und wenn ihr das schafft, dann gewinnt ihr halt das T-Shirt. Wir finanzieren das alles selber. Ihr könnt uns gerne Spenden geben und dann vielleicht auch T-Shirts kriegen, um den langen Weg der Challenge zu umgehen. Ich glaube, der schnellste, wir haben Beta-Test schon hinter uns, den haben wir nämlich gestern gemacht, damit ihr den nicht machen müsst. Natürlich, wie es sich gehört, im Live-Test. Und 10 Leute, also 10 Gruppen haben es schon geschafft. Ich glaube, der schnellste hatte irgendwas mit 7 Stunden 40, wobei einige sagen, sie haben zwischendurch auch geschlafen. Es spielt also keine Rolle, da ständig beizubleiben. Man kann das wie so ein CTF sehen, um praktisch ein T-Shirt zu gewinnen. So, das war's schon. Ich wollte ein bisschen mehr Zeit für andere geben.
Vielen Dank. Thank you. Next up is Unconventional Tactics for Online Campaigning.
Hey there. My name is Lena Rieger and I am digital campaigner and designer for nonprofits across Europe. My topic today is unconventional tactics for digital campaigning. And to start with, I just have a question for you. Did any one of you take an online petition within the last year? You wanna? Okay, nice. That's quite some engagement because online petitions are maybe the most important and most common tactic in online campaigning. But my question is, are there more ways to reach out to a target or maybe engage your supporter more? There are plenty of them, and I'm just going to introduce a few of them today. So one thing you can do is to use localized data to personalize your issue more. Let's take the example of cyclist safety. If I give you the number of cyclist accidents for the whole country, let's say Germany, you might not be able to relate to that number because it's just too big. But if I break that down to your city, your region, maybe your neighborhood, you might be able to access this number and to relate to the topic. A simple implementation of this could look like just a simple online form where the supporter types in his postcode. This form is connected to data about cyclist accidents. You provide the number of the accidents happening in the intermediate surrounding of the supporter, and the supporter is able to relate to that number and engages with your topic. We love engaged supporters because we can ask them for more. You could, for example, ask them to block your target's phone lines. So this tactic works like this. You have an engaged supporter. Of course, you provide the number of your target's office. Make sure that the target's office is staffed at that day. And then you provide a phone script where you can list arguments your supporter could say to your target. Then you invite them to call your target's office. And of course, this tactic is way more effort for your supporter, but also the effect is so much higher than just writing an email or signing an online petition, because the office of your target has to answer directly to that call. Another tactic, ad-busting your target's office. So ad-busting works quite well at conferences or events where a very specific target audience is in one place. So let's say you want to campaign for cycle safety at an automotive conference like IAA. What you do in advance, you prepare ads on Facebook and Google, which are telling about your campaign, about your topic, and then you use IP targeting to show those messages, those ads, only in the block where the conference or the event is happening. So at the conference, for participants of the conference, it will look like these ads are all over the internet. And for you, it's a really cheap way to get a message across to a very specific target audience. So last one is a sneaky one. You could spoof your target's website. This also works quite well with events and conferences, because participants of conferences tend to Google the conference website to look at the program or to check the location. And with targeted ads and smart SEO, you can lead those participants to another website, your website, that might look similar, but has your message and your campaign on it. Of course, it makes sense to always check the legal risks with those tactics. And I'm very happy to talk about those. Thank you.
Thank you. All the speakers are on time, and we have like 6 minutes right now of free time. But we'll continue with the next talk. TSDB mal anders. It's going to be a German talk, I think.
Guten Tag, mein Name ist Sibylian. Ich erzähle euch was über TSDB. Was ist das? Time Series Database. Relativ simpel, ist halt eine Datenbank, einfacher Key-Value-Store. Der Key an der Stelle ist immer ein Zeitpunkt. Das heißt, es wird ein Wert zu einer bestimmten Uhrzeit abgespeichert und zu diesem Wert oder zu diesen Daten gibt es halt wenige oder keine Metainformationen. Und meist werden die Daten einmal geschrieben und danach nur noch gelesen. Klassischer Anwendungsfall dafür ist Monitoring, jeder von euch kennt das, Webserver-Anfragen pro Sekunde oder bei irgendeinem System CPU-Auslastung, RAM-Auslastung, Festplattenverbrauch, was auch immer. Früher sah das so aus, das ist der Klassiker, das RRD-Tool, werden halt, wie man in der Grafik sieht, zu bestimmten Zeiten abgespeichert, wie viele Bits da pro Sekunde über die Leitung gegangen sind. Heutzutage gibt es das in hübsch, ist aber immer noch das Gleiche. Ich sehe zu irgendeinem Zeitpunkt irgendeinen Wert. Was kann man damit machen, wenn es nicht um Monitoring geht? Ich habe einen Use Case aus der Industrie dabei. Stellt euch vor, euer Energieversorger liefert euch nicht nur Strom, sondern ihr könnt euch aussuchen, wo der herkommt. Energieversorger arbeiten grundsätzlich im 15-Minuten-Intervall bei allem, was die tun. Ihr kennt das sicher auch, die ganzen Smart Meter, die demnächst ausgerollt werden, erfassen euren Stromverbrauch im 15-Minuten-Intervall. Aber auch die internen Prozesse bei den Energieversorgern arbeiten alle im 15-Minuten-Intervall. Es stand teilweise sogar mal im Gesetzestext drin. Und mit MS-Cons gibt es einen Industrie-EDI-Standard, der auch auf 15-Minuten-Basis arbeitet. Wenn ihr jetzt die Möglichkeit hättet, euch auszusuchen, welches Kraftwerk euch in welcher Reihenfolge beliefern soll, könnt ihr euch vorstellen, je nachdem, in welcher Reihenfolge ihr die anordnet, setzt sich euer Stromverbrauch unterschiedlich zusammen. Da die ganzen Daten im 15-Minuten-Intervall vorliegen, kann man die natürlich auch hübsch grafisch aufbereiten und sich den Jahresverbrauch anschauen, wo man dann sieht, dass im Winter weniger Sonne ist als im Sommer. Und wenn man dann reinzoomt, dann sieht man auch, dass tagsüber mehr Sonne als Nacht ist. Wäre ein schöner Use Case. Ist aber immer noch relativ langweilig, kommen wir zum kreativen Teil. Wer von euch war beim 34C3 und hat sich im Infrastructure Review diese wunderhübsche Folie angesehen? Das ist das Dashboard vom NOC, das ist der Internet-Traffic vom 34C3 und das NOC hat sich damals gefragt, was zur Hölle ist da passiert und hat nach einigen Grübeln rausgefunden, das ist Morse-Code. Das ist Morse-Code für 34C3, das ist jetzt 2 Jahre her. Letztes Jahr war jemand etwas, ja, hatte mehr Zeit, aber da geht noch was. Das ist das Dashboard von EventPhone, vom POC. Ich weiß nicht, wer von euch das schon mal gesehen hat, erreichbar unter dashboard-eventphone.de. Der witzige Teil sind nicht die Sachen unten, sondern wenn man da oben den Mauszeiger hinhält. Weil das sind keine Bilder, sondern das sind Time-Series-Daten. Wie funktioniert das Ganze? Hier mal am Beispiel, wie man einen Pixel malt. Man malt sich oder man generiert sich passende Metriken, stapelt die übereinander als Stack, färbt die dann passend ein, beziehungsweise sagt, dass die Farbe mal weg soll und dann hat man einfach einen Pixel. Um euch das mal an einem Beispiel zu zeigen, habe ich mir die Mühe gemacht und mal so ein paar Metriken generiert und die dann übereinander gestapelt und eingefärbt. Und weil das von Hand keinen Spaß macht, könnt ihr euch den Code dafür runterladen. Ihr werft da einfach ein Bild rein, kommen hübsche Bilder raus, beziehungsweise hübsche Graphen raus. Und ja, ich würde mich freuen, wenn wir auf dem Event jemanden finden, der zufällig Zugang zu einem etwas dickeren Internetanschluss hat und dem NOC den Wunsch erfüllt, dass diesmal nicht gemaust wird. Vielen Dank.
Let's go.
Yeah, this year I've worked on my master thesis and I came along a lot of problems. And well, a lot of papers and articles focus on new results, but there's little reproduction. I had to reproduce something, but there was no source code. The technical details in the paper, let's say they were almost non-existent. And the framework that was used was kind of, it was a known one, but it was really complicated. So basically I had to implement everything from scratch, which is not what should happen. So it cost me a lot of time. So what can be done better about it? Well, first, if you do any research, release your source code. It isn't that difficult, and it helps everyone else a great way. Second, every little detail, like hyperparameters, what other parameters you used, documented in the paper, and if that may be too long, then in the appendices, or some other way, but definitely document it, make it known to the people, because it shouldn't require month-long tries and writing to the author to get somehow understanding what actually was done. It should be inferable from the paper itself, so that should all you need to know. Third, use a common machine learning framework, for example, TensorFlow 2.0, there are others, but don't invent your own one. Maybe that's more intellectually challenging, but everyone else will hate you for it. So just don't do it and save everyone a lot of trouble and use a known one so they can get to work and use your results faster. Fourth, write source code in package form. For example, in Python, which is used very often in machine learning, it's very easy. There's like the Python package index, so just prepare your things for that so you can upload it after you hand it in your publication so others can simply install it and have all the required dependencies in one command and don't need to search around and try to find how this thing can be run. So only the data sets which are too large to put in as dependencies have to be downloaded manually, but everything else will be ready. And five, follow clean code rules. So, I mean, we all know this thing, we write something in school and then years later we can't read it ourselves. Well, in source code, while it's written with a machine, you can see the letters, but you don't necessarily understand them anymore. So just write cleanly, search in the favorite search engine and just follow that. It isn't that difficult. Maybe follow a pledge. Hold yourself and others to these five rules. And if you're a journal editor or know someone who is, maybe don't accept publications that don't fulfill these 5 points. And if enough journals would follow that, then it would be adopted en masse very fast. So I think that saves a lot of people a lot of time and doesn't take too much time from you. Thank you.
Thank you. So next up is accessibility for adult autistics and at larger events. Yep. So there we go.
Okay. Hello. So it's about accessibility for autistics at large events. Children are not my department, so it's only for adults. The first thing I would like to encourage. Why do I need that? Maybe we don't have autistics, you probably do. And considering accessibility helps everyone. Like a person in a wheelchair needs an elevator to get to the third floor, but everybody is happy to get to the third floor with an elevator when they're sick, for instance. So we are all disabled sometimes, and it helps the quality of your event if you consider those things. Tolerate odd behavior and make policies to tolerate odd behavior. Just don't force people to be all the same, you know that, but make policies. Allow people to leave the room at any time. Some people want to smoke, some people want to pee, and some people want to be alone for a moment. Make it allowed. Don't force people into the party. Often autistics have trouble with sensory stimulation and social situations. Also, they know best what is best for them. It's good to give people a chance to be alone, but also to give people a chance to be in a group in a way that's not overstimulating. For instance, here we have the Quiet Cube, which is like a quieter hug center where people can participate in the Congress, but not be too overwhelmed. Be predictable with your schedule. For instance, like this, indicate when there are the social times so people can plan their stay and leave when they need. Autistics often really like to plan. School your medical staff. In a nutshell, problems with autistics is that they are overwhelmed. There is too much information. They're going, and so that happens a lot to autistics and quite intensely. Meltdowns mean to be very angry, like to appear like in a rage, and shutdowns mean to not talk, to look unconscious or asleep. Those things happen. Don't unnecessarily touch people if you know that they're autistic, because touch can also be overwhelming and have a place where people can calm down. This is a bonus level. If you want to be all creatures welcome event, you can like print cards for people who cannot talk at the moment. It makes them feel more invited. Those cards might not fit everybody, but it's a good sign to tell them that they are invited. If you want to talk more, you can contact C3 Orti or me, or come to the Quiet Cube and ask. We're happy to help. Thank you.
Thank you. So next up is going to be disruption tolerant networking. We are also disruption tolerant here. Delay tolerant especially. All right, go ahead.
Hi. Slide?
Vielleicht auf den Schwarzbutton gedrückt. What? Achso, warte mal. So.
That's good. Okay. So, some delay, as all for the topic. So, today I'm going to give you a brief introduction into the world of delay or disruption tolerant networking and motivate all this with the DTN7 software, or DTN7 Go to be precisely. Even today, we have a lot of situations where you don't have some reliable uplink. For example, your internet access is blocked, or you don't have any infrastructure, for example, in the disaster scenarios. Also, you have transmissions from rural areas, for example, for your sensor network, or if you're at the Digital Gipfel somewhere in Brandenburg. Furthermore, perhaps you're somewhere in deep space, so you can't plug in your internet. The typical solution is some wireless mesh networking. But even nowadays, there are situations where your mesh network doesn't fulfill your doesn't help you. So here we have the picture of a typical mesh network as in your Freifunk community. So if you want to establish a connection from the left to the right node, your routing algorithm just determines a path, for example, the dotted one, and you can exchange packets. However, for TCP, for example, you need the round trip, so you have to send packets forth and back. If your nodes are very far away from each other, this could take some time, for example, because you have such low bandwidth. Furthermore, if your link breaks down, for example, like here, TCP doesn't work nicely anymore, because TCP isn't designed for partition networks. Yeah. In real life, you don't have those connected components. For example, if you're in a disaster scenario and you're somewhere outside with your smartphone, you're in your group, with your peer group, with your people, and you just have small mesh networks for yourself, but you cannot connect to the other ones. So it's always just small groups. Furthermore, people are switching between these groups, so you have some kind of mobility in this. So we have some network where you don't want any end-to-end connection, you don't want extra network round trips or extra package, and well, it must also work if it's not really connected and the nodes are moving. So that's where we're coming to delay or disruption-tolerant networking. In DTN, packets are transmitted hop by hop in a store carry forward manner. So packets are just exchanged from node to node when they're meeting. For example, opportunistically because they're just passing by, or it's scheduled, for example, for satellites in space. This looks like here in this example. We have these two groups as before, and the upper node wants to transmit some data to the lower one. Now, the upper node creates a package, and it's like it owns this package now, it has it, and it will transmit it to its neighboring nodes, and this time in the same component. Now, the node from the downer component moves up because it has some kind of mobility, gets a package, moves back, and now it's delivered. So, this is not really possible with like the Internet Protocol and TCP, especially TCP. So there are other protocols, for example, the bundle protocol, and there's currently an IETF draft, DTN BPBIS 17, which just describes such an architecture. It aims to obsolete this old RFC 5050. So there you have the package looking like this one. You have a primary block with your metadata, like in your IP header, and then you have canonical other blocks. At the end, you have a payload block where your payload is there, obviously. In this case, hello 3063. And you can have other blocks, for example, a hop count block, which is the same like a hop count in the current version of the Internet Protocol. So you can just extend your bundles of transport. All this is implemented in our software we're going to present here. It's DTN7 Go, and it's implementation of this delay-tolerant networking with the bundle protocol. It's also a router, and it has an interface to be programmed for or to be receive packages. Those bundles, as shown earlier, like the packages, can be exchanged over different protocols like TCP-based or the physical layer of LoRa. So we have small antennas where you can exchange the packets. Everything else is possible. We have an interface for this. Furthermore, before I just said the package exchange from node to node, but if you have a huge network, you want to have some kind of interlink routing. So we have different routing algorithms as shown there. Furthermore, you can create these packages with our API or just use our software as a library. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Next up is Tesla Radar.
Hello, my name is Martin, and I'm talking about Tesla Radar in a very brief talk today. First, a little bit of an introduction about myself. My name is Martin, and I'm known for Bluetooth security research, and that is so long ago that I think most of you won't even remember. I'm having a hard time remembering this, too. And this is my 21st consecutive Congress. And, of course, I'm a Model 3 owner, and that's why I came into this research. So what's the issue? Some Tesla models always transmit a unique ID via Bluetooth low energy. This is most known, the Model 3, and most likely also upcoming models like the Model Y that implement the so-called phone key feature. This is a keyless Go kind of technology that doesn't require a key fob, but uses your own mobile in order to unlock the car and allows you to drive the car without a key. And this ID that is transmitted continuously is required for this phone key feature. So the thing is that this ID does not change over time and you cannot turn it off. So it's a beacon you're driving around that everybody else is able to spot and can locate. So anyone can track vehicles without effort, and this is, at least in Europe, a privacy issue. And that could facilitate car theft, car crashing. I don't know if you know what that is. A friend brought that up to me. That's when people wait with their cars at intersections and wait for a well-insured car to come around the corner, which has no right of way, and they just enter the intersection and the car crashes into their car and they make some money out of that. So that could be facilitated with that as well. Of course, speed measurement is something you can use it for. And worst of all is that it facilitates automated personal observation. So the situation at the moment is I wrote a letter to Tesla and told them that I believe this is a privacy issue. And they replied back very friendly and very professionally that they have they see that differently, and they say that because there's so many automated license plate readers around in the country anyways, so it doesn't really make a big difference if they would randomize any identifiers with their cars. So ALPR, that's this license plate reader technology, that is an argument for the USA. It's a lazy excuse, some would say, but in Europe there's at least the GDPR. So if only there was an app for that, I thought, and there was no app that helped addressing this issue. So I did this Android app, which is called Tesla Radar, and it's a little bit like Pokemon Go. It has the intention to raise awareness for the issue by spotting all these Teslas that you find when you wander around with this app. And it transmits it back to the server where a heat map is generated out of the locations of the detected cars. And of course, there's gamification in the app. And of course, this should lead to a situation where Tesla fixes the issue eventually. So please consider to install the app, share your data with the service, collect radar score, and enjoy gamification. And please, please pay attention to the ads. It's a free app, but it's ad supported. And you don't have to be really interested in anything you see. Just give it a try clicking on it. So if you're still not convinced that you should go for the app, you're in very good company. The guy you see there is Thomas from the Netherlands. He's an electronics engineer, and he took it to the next level, in my opinion. He installed a Tesla radar station next to a highway in the Netherlands, and he's leading the rankings from then on. So he spotted by himself like 2,000 unique cars in about 1 month time. And finally, that's the thank you. You see, it's already 16 different countries, 4,700 and a little bit different cars that have been spotted. And I would be really thankful if you joined in. Find me afterwards. I have stickers, and I will most likely hang around at the Telnet assembly. And if you want to talk to me, find me there. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is open source licenses. Yep.
My name is Hong Phu Tang. I'm speaking on behalf of the Open Source Initiative. So I thought I'd start with a very quick English version of Jeopardy, as I couldn't play last night. Abbreviation 1000, OSI. What is Open Source Initiative? OSD. What is open source definition? So Open Source Initiative is a global nonprofit organization that looks after the open source definition, We are also the community recognized body for reviewing and approving open source licenses. Open source definition. This is a document that published by us to determine whether a software license can be labeled as the open source certification mark, or we call it OSI certified. This open source definition was originally derived from the Debian free software guidelines. So open source doesn't just mean access to the source code, but also the distribution terms of open source software must comply with the following criteria that you can find on our website, opensource.org. GPL, MIT, Apache license, Mozilla public license. These are very popular open source license were approved by the OSI, but these are not all. If you go to our website, you will find close to 100 other open source approved licenses. The core purpose of the license review process is to provide software freedom and to ensure that any approved open source license comply again with the open source definition. Some interesting fact about the process. All the licenses must go through a public review process. There is a community discussion on every single license on a mailing list, and the decision process normally takes up to 60 days and an extra 30 days if there is a submission of a revised version. How to submit a request? You need to understand the open source definition and ensure that your license complies with it. Identify the submission type. Ensure you have an appropriate standing to submit such a request. Join the license review mailing list and submit a formal request by just sending an email to that list. Go to opensource.org/approval for all the details. Or you can also find me at the end if you have questions. I am at the critical decentralization in Hall 2, where all the colorful Asian-looking tables are. Or you can also send me physical mails. I love them. And if you put on your address, I will reply within the Congress. So that's it. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next up is soldering workshops.
Hi. Okay, so my first slide is where the hardware hacking area is. It's basically across the hall. Right towards the bathroom on the left side if you go in the main door. So how do I switch slides? Okay, so what is the hardware hacking area for? We basically have over 100 soldering irons, 30 of which are just dedicated to people wanting to solder anytime they want. You can bring whatever you want to solder. If you didn't bring anything to Congress that you want to solder, we also are selling kits mostly between about noon and 5. Every day. And I also made a badge this year that is in my pocket. Basically, this little soldering kit, and it's by donation. And the donations will determine what my budget is next year. So if you think 600 isn't enough for Congress, donate more than what you think it's worth, because that will determine how many I get to make next year, because I'm not rich. Okay, so I'm also teaching a number of workshops, and my workshop that I'm doing tonight, tomorrow, and the next day is an introduction to Arduino soldering and programming. And it's basically 1 hour of soldering for surface mount and through-hole soldering, and then 1 hour of learning digital input, digital output, analog input, analog output, and my goal is to stay there until everybody's shield works. And you sign up between 3 and 5 today or tomorrow, I'll be at the hardware hacking area. My other workshop that I'm doing tomorrow night is building this toy, which you can see what they're doing on the video. The one labeled Recharge, you basically push it and it's to recharge yourself, so to take a moment to just relax. It was designed because a person in my hardware hacking space has a very anxious girlfriend who needs to constantly remember to just take a moment to calm down before giving a speech and so on. The other one is just a toy where if you push it with the right tempo, it will change directions or get brighter. And that's just to learn through-hole soldering. And that's the slide in case the video didn't work. This is surface mount for terrified beginners. It's taught 10 different times during Congress. There's a sign-up sheet at the end of the kit sales area and the hardware hacking area if you want to take that workshop. There are still spaces left. This is sold out. There are still spaces for this workshop where you build a Ardu synth that's taught by Mitch Altman. So the first two workshops that I talked about with the recharge in the heart or the intro to Arduino, that's my workshop. The rest are just other people's. This is where you build a music synthesizer, and there's still a few spots left. The Maker Bueno is sold out. I believe this one may have a couple spots left. And you build your own Geiger counter. There's an air quality monitor workshop, and all of the information on how to sign up for the workshops given by other people are on the hardware hacking area website, wiki, and then follow all of their directions on how to get the kit and sign up. And then there's two FPGA workshops. One is to build a stopwatch, and I believe it is free, and it's tonight, and you borrow the materials, which is how it can be free, because these are not cheap kits. If you want to buy the kit, you have to talk to the workshop giver. And then there's also this FPGA in your USB port workshop. And that's all.
Thank you. And next up is exciting developments around Linux on phones. Very tiny. So.
Thank you. So my name is Jan. I'm from the UbiPorts project. So obviously I am not an independent source on this topic, but I wanted to use this opportunity to spread my propaganda anyways. So Linux on phones. Why even bother? Yeah, because Android is not great. There's many other reasons. I talked about this last year, but this year I would just want to quickly remind you of some of the projects that are exciting right now. This is my personal opinion, so we won't target all the projects there are in this area because there's a lot going on actually. But I just want to remind you of some of the things that are going to be interesting next year. First one, obviously, since I'm from UbiPorts, is Ubuntu Touch. Ubuntu Touch started out as the official version for phones from Ubuntu, from Canonical. It was moved to a community project, which is UbiPorts, 2 years ago. And it's still going strong. And I think that's an exciting one to watch. Next one, obviously, you have to talk about KDE Plasma, which is an adaption of Plasma Mobile, which is an adaption of KDE Plasma for mobile devices. Very exciting. It's not entirely meant for daily use yet, but they are really getting there. It's really amazing what they are achieving in fairly short time, and it's going to be very, very interesting, I think. PostMarket OS is a little different. They have some different architectural approaches, but they are truly amazing in what they do. They really challenge what everybody is doing, and their focus is on improving the longevity of phones, so you can really use a phone that is 10 years old, and it runs just fine. It's based on Alpine Linux, which is very, very lightweight, so it works amazingly on really old hardware as well. Also not meant for daily use yet, but we might see this change this year. Or at least in the next 2 years, maybe. So let's talk some hardware. Very exciting is the Pine phone. Pine is a company that originally made kind of a Raspberry Pi clone. But they then moved on and made a laptop and made a phone. Now I'm making a phone and it's starting to ship now. It comes in at $150. It's free hardware. It's very exciting, I think. And it's actual Linux on there. And the software is provided by open source communities. So it's very non-corporate, I think, as non-corporate as it gets. If you want corporate, this might also be something interesting for you. So this is an up-and-coming German startup. They are trying to make a phone entirely in the EU, I think mostly in Germany, actually. And they are experimenting with different alternative or mobile operating systems as well. So here you see Ubuntu Touch running on the prototype. So how do I install if I don't want to buy an expensive device? Because most of the supported ones are actually fairly old, so they are available on the cheap. So this is the UbiPorts installer. UbiPorts fairly early on said, okay, we need to make it as easy as possible to install on third-party hardware. So you can just pick up a Nexus 5 used for like 50 euros on eBay and then run the installer. So the installer tries to make it as easy as possible so your grandma could install Ubuntu Touch on her device herself without you looking over her shoulder. That's the goal, really. And now we're working on getting other operating systems in there. So if there's someone in the audience who's maintaining any Android alternative or even an Android derivative that needs to be easier to install, hit me up or go to github.com/ubiports/ubiports installer and contribute your installation instructions there. We created a config file format to make it really easy to describe what needs to happen, what the installer needs to do to install on the device. So you just have to activate developer mode and the rest happens automatically, basically. So that's it. Here are the links that we talked about. On the other side, you see how to get in touch. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with all of this with Linux on mobile devices. So yeah, take care. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, next up is Hacking Ecology. Let's go.
Ja, hi, ich bin Mario. Willkommen bei Hacking Ecology Teil 2. Teil 1 war im vergangenen Jahr ein Talk von Theodor, der mit dem gleichen Titel quasi einen Talk gehalten hat. Und danach stellte sich die Frage, wie können Hackerinnen und Hacker bei verschiedenen Umweltprojekten etwas Gutes beitragen? Und dieses Jahr haben wir 4 sehr konkrete Projekte beigebracht. Das erste ist Vidit. Da geht es einfach darum, Daten zu visualisieren. Denn sehr viele Daten sind frei im Internet verfügbar, beispielsweise von der NASA, von der Weltbank, von der UN, von verschiedensten Wetterdiensten. Aber die sind eben schwer abzugreifen, weil es verschiedene Datenformate sind, verschiedene Datenbanken, verschiedene Websites. Und hier können quasi wir helfen, indem wir ein gutes Visualisierungstool im Web bauen, mit dem solche Daten eben leicht visualisiert und anschaulich gemacht werden können. Denn grundsätzlich ist es so, dass es sehr viele besorgniserregende Trends in der Welt gibt, beispielsweise die ansteigende Temperatur durch den Klimawandel, aber auch unser ansteigender Energiekonsum bei allen Energieträgern oder auch die Entwaldungsrate. Das zweite Projekt ist Snooze Against the Machine. Und zwar, ihr kennt das vielleicht alle, eigentlich wollt ihr etwas für die Umwelt tun, für soziale Projekte, gegen die kapitalistische Verwertungsgesellschaft. Ihr wollt die Revolution, aber manchmal wollt ihr auch einfach nur ausschlafen. Das ist zum Glück kein Widerspruch mehr, sondern was wir hier machen wollen, ist eine einfache App entwickeln, wo ihr jedes Mal, wenn ihr den Snooze-Button drückt, werdet ihr quasi einfach spenden, und zwar an eine Organisation eurer Wahl. Könnt ihr euch quasi frei aussuchen, welchen Betrag an welche Organisation, auch über vielleicht die Gesundheitsrisiken von Snoozing informieren. Also relativ straightforwardes Projekt. Und im Idealfall würden wir das Ganze noch mit Voice Command kombinieren, dass ihr morgens nichts mal mehr aufstehen müsst, um den Snooze-Button zu drücken, sondern ihr müsst nur noch quasi Shut up and take my money sagen. Der Wecker schaltet sich aus, spendet Geld und ihr könnt in Ruhe mit gutem Gewissen ausschlafen. Okay, das dritte Projekt, da geht es um Wurzelrhizotrone, das machen Kollegen von mir in der Forschung. Wir wissen sehr, sehr wenig, was unterirdisch vor sich geht. Wie wachsen Pflanzen unterirdisch? Und gleichzeitig sind Böden eine der größten Kohlenstoffsenken in der Welt. Und was wir also machen wollen, ist dieses Wurzelwachstum irgendwie monitoren. Und was man also macht, ist eine Art transparente Röhre, eine Rhizotron in den Boden einlassen und da eine Art Scannerleiste reinbauen, der sich einmal im Tag sozusagen dreht und das Wurzelwachstum um diese Röhren herum scannt. Solche Geräte gibt es, kosten 20.000 Euro und funktionieren nicht gut. Und es ist eigentlich ein sehr einfaches Projekt. Wir wollen also einen mobilen Dokumentenscanner auseinanderschrauben, den habe ich mitgebracht. Vielleicht kennt sich jemand aus mit Microcontrollern, mit 3D-Druck, dann kann die Person hier gerne bei diesem Projekt mithelfen. Und das vierte Projekt, da möchten wir eigentlich hauptsächlich den Kontakt vermitteln. Das Grundproblem hier ist, dass jedes Jahr sehr viele Rehkids in dem Mähwerk von großen Mähmaschinen sterben, weil diese Tiere sich eben nur wegducken und nicht wegrennen in diesem jungen Stadium. Und dann geraten sie quasi, wenn sie sich geduckt haben, in das Mähwerk, weil sie nicht weggerannt sind. Dieses Projekt Wildretter existiert bereits. Was man also macht, ist quasi Drohnen mit Infrarotkameras einsetzen, um diese Tiere zu finden. Und was jetzt gerade noch fehlt, ist einfach eine Navigations-App, mit der quasi das Bodenteam dirigiert und navigiert werden kann. Dass man also sagen kann, Person XY läuft jetzt zu Punkt P, 30 Meter nach Nordosten, hat das Tier gefunden oder nicht, um einfach diese Tiere dort zu retten. Auch eine relativ einfache, straightforward App, wo wir aber persönlich nicht helfen können. Aber vielleicht hat jemand von euch Interesse und möchte dort mitmachen. Wenn ihr grundsätzlich an einem von diesen Projekten Interesse habt, dann kommt gerne vorbei. Wir haben morgen bei Wikipacka einen kleinen Space reserviert um 19 Uhr in der Wikipacka Bibliothek. Und wenn ihr diesen Talk online seht, dann könnt ihr uns auch gerne kontaktieren, einfach per E-Mail. Vielleicht auch später als Videoaufzeichnung einfach uns anschreiben. Wir freuen uns, wenn Leute von euch kommen und uns helfen wollen. Das sind alles sehr viele spannende Projekte, finde ich. Danke.
Vielen Dank. Thank you. Next up is Make Peace and Time with Accounting. Wait a minute, where is it? There we go. Make Peace and Time with Accounting.
Hello, everyone. All right, so my name is Luis, and my day job is programming, but I'm tracking my finances with NewCash since late 2016. And NewCash is an accounting software that has been developed since the late 90s, so it's pretty mature. And it's free as in free speech and free as in free beer, and it works in about any operating system. And for the accountants here, NewCash uses double entry accounting, which I'm gonna define a little bit next. So accounting lets you track money movements across accounts. And accounts can be, for example, your bank account, your checking or savings account, or a retirement account if you're in the US, or life insurance if you're in France, and I'm sure Germany has something similar. Or an account can represent where money is coming from, for example, your salary, or salaries if you work in different companies, or tips or wages, any kind of wages. And or accounts can represent where money is going to, for example, food, transportation, services, for example, your phone bills, internet bills, any kind of bills. Or accounts can also represent how much money you owe, so any kind of debt, a student loan, or taxes you'll have to pay at a later date. And an accounting book is a collection of such accounts. So an accounting book centralizes all those accounts. And accounts let you categorizes your finances. And centralizing and categorizing your finances has a lot of benefits. So for example, I think one of the most obvious one is to be able to track how you're spending your money. For example, one thing I like to do is to sort recurring expenses from non-recurring expenses, right? So recurring expenses are gonna be bills that are gonna be likely paid automatically every month. For example, my phone bill, streaming services, internet bill, electricity, whatever. From other expenses, for example, traveling to CCC is something I do, it's a one-off operation. And doing that may help you compress your budget. So, how much money you're spending every month. By knowing how you're spending it, you can maybe spend less or oh, I'm spending this much for streaming or but do I really watch this many movies every month or something like this, right? Or do I need to pay this much for my phone bill? Doing accounting can also help you spot hidden fees. For example, banks, especially in the US, really like hidden fees. You pay for something, and they'll add up a fee on top of it, and they won't tell you, right? And by doing accounting, you can spot that very easily. And something I like to do, for example, is, at the end of the year, you go see your banker and tell him, oh, here is how much I spent as fees with your bank. Can you do something about it? It's it gives you that power. Doing accounting also lets you catch mistakes very easily. For example, that happened to me. I made a check, and 6 months later, it was cashed out for a completely different sum, much bigger sum. And I would have never code that without doing accounting, because I would have forgot about it. I would have said, oh, that must be the right amount. Or also missed reimbursements. right? You like loan some money to someone or like something. By doing accounting, you can remember, you can see that you've given money out, or you can also do that to track how much money insurances are supposed to like give you back. And overall, doing that can reduce anxiety about your financial situation. And that's why I'm saying you can make peace by doing accounting. And a lot of things related to money can be like very anxiety inducing. For example, like debt can create a lot of anxiety. Taxes can create a lot of anxiety. And doing accounting like really helps with that. Also, you can like save time with accounting because by having like all your financial information categorized and centralized, you know any amount you might need for any kind of like computation or projection on your finances. For example, taxes are very complicated in the US, and knowing all your different kind of income, whether they're like a salary or interests or dividends or tips, that really helps you like project and compute your taxes, even though we have software to help you with that. There is other benefits that are not coming from centralization or categorization. One thing that I like about accounting is, for example, you can actually like, you know, make banks compete with each other. You don't have to trust, like, you know, what people usually do is that one bank and that bank has some like features to like do that categorization thing. By doing it yourself, you can like really have banks compete with each other if they have like more interesting rates or fees. And you can also like not trust a single entity with all your like financial information. Something that your bank cannot do is track your cash expenses, right? You just like get money from the ATM, spend it. The bank doesn't know how you're spending it. Cash is anonymous and it's a really powerful thing. But you might want to track it with accounting. You can also track checks. Checks are still like, they're not really used anymore, but like, you know, oftentimes it happens. You have to use them. And it's really annoying when you make a check and then it's not cashed out for 6 months. You can track that with accounting and you're not surprised when a check is being cashed out. Doing accounting is a great first step towards running personal or business finances. It's especially great for running like nonprofit organizations or small businesses. It will also help you understand economy and politics. It's a great step towards that. There is also a few bad reasons for like I think not doing it. One is that accounting only serves rich people. I don't think that's true. I think that middle class people, people with less income, will also benefit a lot from accounting and from being able to like see how they're spending their money and can plan for future projects better. It's boring and takes so much time. That's completely true, but I think you're gonna get that time back by doing that, by having more money for projects. And I don't think I'm gonna have time for the last one, but X does it for me. Maybe you wanna reconsider that. If X works for you, maybe you keep it. But you always have a conflict of interest with anyone handling your finances because they want your money, but you also want your money. And doing accounting yourself helps you resolve that conflict of interest. No one can like manage your money better than yourself. And that's it. I will help you set up NewCash at Congress, so feel free to contact me, and tomorrow I'll explain how the Valley works. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, as long as we are not over time, we can arrange something with the countdown. So next up is Duocracy Done Well.
So hi, I am Merlin, and I am a board member of Hackerspace Ghent, and I am going to talk about how we manage our community. So the first version of Hackerspace Ghent started 10 years ago, and we had only two rules. Be excellent to each other and decide everything by consensus. We thought common sense would solve all other problems, but we were incredibly wrong. After 4 years, our hackerspace was on the brink of destruction because of internal conflict. A lot of people were leaving for other hackerspaces, and there were even talks about forking the hackerspace and stuff like that. So, as a last-ditch effort, we started the Hack the Hackerspace workshops. Basically, workshops to create a system for our hackerspace, for our community, that gets the best out of people. So, as a result, we created the Hackerspace Blueprint. This is a small book that explains how our community works and how we solve problems. And it's available online for free. It's also open source. And I hope that if you're interested, that you go to the URL hackerspace.design and that you read it in and that you can maybe use some of the ideas to solve problems in your own communities. This is the most important slide in my entire presentation, hackerspace.design. Go there in your browser and read the book. So I'm now going to talk about, we've been using this system for 6 years, and what are some of the lessons learned? The first thing is a duocracy. Specifically about a duocracy is that you do not need the opinion of everyone who is affected by your action. If you are the person who does something, then you are the person who decides how it should be done. Even if you're not the most competent person, even if your what you are going to do is not the best solution, you can still decide to do that without getting the opinion of everyone else. The second thing is interpersonal conflict. This is a big issue in communities. This is one of the main reasons why communities explode. We as human beings have this natural tendency to try to ignore interpersonal conflict as long as it doesn't involve us ourselves. But this is a really bad thing because we hope that interpersonal conflict will solve itself, but it almost never does. So how do you actually solve this? The first thing is that you have to have people responsible to monitor and solve interpersonal conflict. Literally assign people them. In our hackerspace, this is the role of the board. The second thing is that if interpersonal conflict happens, first use the private talk pattern. Talk with the individuals privately and discuss the issues directly and without blame. And then after you've talked with everybody, put them together and have also a private conversation with all the involved parties and moderate it. We've been doing this for 6 years, and every single time when we tried it, it actually succeeded in solving the issues. But it's very important that you make people responsible to do this, otherwise nobody will. The second thing is rules and loopholes. So one of the issues with being a hacker is that you're incredibly good at finding loopholes. So running a hacker community using rules is an incredibly bad idea. What's better is to actually motivate people to do the right thing. Create a culture where everybody works in the best interest of the hackerspace, not because they're forced to, but because they actually want to. If you see people who are not doing that, you can talk to them, you can coach them, and if they refuse to actually do that, just kick them out. These kind of people, whatever they contribute to your hackerspace, they will take away more than they contribute. The third thing is meetings. Meetings is also a really big issue in a duocracy because meetings give power to the people with opinions. And we do not want that. We want to give power to the people who actually do stuff. So the best meeting is no meeting. Do as little meetings as possible. Thanks. This is the second most important slide in my presentation because it has the URL again. Go to hackerspace.design, send me an email. If you want to talk to me in person, you can also come to the HSBE assembly. And I think tomorrow I will do a much longer talk in the assembly to explain more parts of the hackerspace blueprint. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Open Laser Tag.
Hi, I'm Florian.
I'm Jules.
We are building an open source laser tag system. For those of you who don't know what laser tag is, it's like catching each other but with light. It's the same technology like in your TV remote.
And after playing laser tag with some friends, We sat together in Berlin at the Spree and thought, well, this can't be so hard to do this ourselves. And then we searched on the internet if other people already did it, and of course there were lots, and most of them did it in really complicated ways. And so we thought, okay, this is too hard for us, so we have to do it simpler. And so we went for the journey to build a simple open laser tag system.
Yeah, and we got some ideas about our system, what we wanted to achieve. It should be cheap because we want to build a lot of taggers and give them to our friends to play with them. And the technology should be accessible and flexible. And that's a system design we came up with.
Yeah, starting at the bottom, you see the tagger, which is basically the infrared communications hardware. And on top of the tagger, there is some Bluetooth. So the tagger is containing ESP32 and some ER infrared components. And they communicate via Bluetooth with your smartphone. For now, we have an Android app only, so we need somebody to do iOS stuff. And the app does most of the logic part, while the tagger is only basically a transmission layer. And on top of all of that, there is sitting the server, which is communicating between all the different players.
Yeah, that's how our first prototyping looked like. That's the ESP32 you see here. And only what you else need for a tagger is this microcontroller and infrared LED and an infrared receiver. And a lens to focus the infrared, because you don't want to have a like widespread infrared beam like in your TV remote, but you want a very focused light stream to make it harder, of course, to hit and with your light. That was our next prototype built out of PVC tubes. And you see the lens on the right picture. And on top, this black thing is an infrared receiver. And what I can say also about this, there's no PCB involved in this. So you don't have to, you just can buy this the components and put them together. And you have a tagger.
And our newer designs of a tagger casing look like this. So they are 3D printed and more custom made. Yeah, and that's where we are in the moment from the hardware side. The software side of the tagger is also pretty far. So you can actually tag someone and he will get hit and we'll get a notification. And yeah, that's how we are, how far we are today. And now we can say where you can meet us.
Yeah, what still is missing is like the game logic. So we can't play a game right now, but the technology works. So yeah, if you want to contact us, there's our GitHub repository and our Twitter handles.
And you can find us for the next half an hour outside of the lecturing hall here at the LED palm tree. There we will be waiting for other hackers who want to play laser tag. We actually have a pile of hardware with and parts, so we can actually build stuff today.
Yeah, and we also ask for a workshop slot and at a open hardware at a hardware hacking area. And but we didn't get a time slot yet, so we will maybe post it on Twitter. If you're interested in building your own tagger, come to there or meet us in the next half an hour at the LED palm tree. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next up is binary analysis course.
Thank you. Today I would like to talk with you about a program I've been developing, not in the sense of code, but as a course. So the table of contents, it has three topics: who am I, just a short introduction about myself, what is it, and how can you access it? So first of all, something about myself. My name is Max Kerst. I go by the name of Libra as a nickname. I'm the administrator, or one of the administrators, of the malware research group on Telegram, on which I have a talk tomorrow. I'm currently working as a threat intelligence analyst. I previously worked as an Android malware analyst. I made some tooling for that, and I write blogs on my own website about which this talk is. So what is this binary analysis course? So it's a free online course that uses free and open source tooling. Nowadays, you have a lot of guides and helplines, especially for paid tooling, which is perfectly fine in corporate environments, but especially if you're starting out as a student or you're just new to the field, you don't want to spend so much money just to see if it fits you. There are great open source tools out there which work for free, and this course uses them and focuses on them, so you have a low-level entry. So it has a really heavy focus on the how and the why stuff works. It doesn't jump to conclusions. You get explained every step of the way. And if you know something already, then you can just skip that part and move on. So the step-by-step approach is used in every article, where you get a sense of how it works, why it works, meaning you can repeat experiments that are being done in the course on other binaries you find yourself, CTF challenges you later on participate in, or anything else you want to put your hands on. So as a last kind of unique part of the course, it does not contain images. I think the images are great to use in some cases, but it focuses me to clearly explain everything I want to in text, making it also easier for people to search back later on. Maybe you read an article and half a year later you think back, oh, I read about this on this site and it was somewhere in this article. If you have stuff in images or in videos, it's really hard to find something back. But if it's fully written out in text, you can use the search function of your browser or any text editor you loaded my website in, and you can find things back. So some of the topics that are covered, they start from the basics, starting from CPU architecture, how does it work, why does it work, moving on to assembly language, as it's a core concept you need to know. You will also learn how to write some assembly and compile that to get a different view of what is the difference between compiled and decompiled code, or disassembled rather. You have multiple analysis methods for multiple file types. It ranges from a Linux DDoS bot that I analyzed to a browser plugin to Magecart JavaScript. So the malware analysis in there is also for a variety of platforms. Like I said, it's based for the browser, for Linux. There's stuff for Windows coming on. But there's also more, because you can read my articles and you can read the analysis, which I hope is really enjoyable. That's at least I think writing them is. But the question is, how do you continue then? Because I found some cool sample that I wrote about, but it's not as much fun to just keep on replicating the same sample. So what is also focused within the course is, how do you actually find new samples? Where do you find interesting samples? And if you're searching for something really specific, where do you find this? Let's say you want a really specific version of Mirai. Then you need to search for this somewhere, somehow, and you want to find this. And additionally, recognizing structures and patterns is really important, as they also come back into any language you use. If you have a specific type of obfuscation, you can view this in decompiled assembly code, like pseudo-C, or you can see it in JavaScript, in C#. In any language you come back to, you'll see certain structures and patterns, like a for loop, a while loop. So they're also discussed in great detail. So how can you access it? Well, it's on my website, which is on the screen right now. You can take a picture, wait until the talk is uploaded. Or remember it. I do tend to publish roughly at least one article a month based on how lengthy they are. I publish announcements on Twitter beforehand, and also when something new comes out. So if you follow me on Twitter, you'll also be up to date on that. Additionally, if you have feedback, suggestions, or ideas, my Twitter DMs are always open. You can just send me a message, and we can discuss anything. After this, I'll also be somewhere around here in the area, probably just outside the exit of the Borg room. So feel free to hit me up.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So that concludes today's session. Please give a big round of applause for all of the speakers who were here on stage today. Also, for having to deal with 24 speakers from different countries, a big round of applause for the translation team, please.